Worship Come Alive, and our topic today is, what is contemporary worship? Our topic yesterday, as you may recall, was the tradition, who needs it? And our topic, not tomorrow, we don't have a session with me anyhow tomorrow, have a session on Thursday, making it happen in the congregation. So, let us just take a brief review of last time. I like to point out that our tradition is biblical, it's Catholic, it's confessional, it's national, it's parochial, and finally, it's even personal. And all of those levels, I think, are important, and we want to give honor where honor is due. Back in Waterloo, Ontario, I was part of a team that had to produce for radio 50 second, less than a minute, meditations for this radio station. And three or four times a year, I had to come up with 10 of these. And to say what you want to say in 50 seconds is really something. But I came up with these. First of all, Grandma's Vote. This will ring a bell with those of you who were here yesterday. I heard a good description of tradition the other day. Tradition, someone said, is a one way of giving my grandfather and grandmother a vote in the decisions I must make today. I like that because it suggests a kind of transgenerational democracy. If I have a tradition, a family tradition or religious tradition or whatever, then I'm giving my forebears a voice and a vote in the choices I must make today. Not the only vote, not the deciding vote, but a voice and vote nonetheless that gives honor to all those who've gone before me. I don't have to be an Oedipus to be thoroughly modern or mature. I don't have to turn my back on history. In fact, by honoring my tradition, I may even learn something. I regarded these over the radio anyhow as proto-evangelism. In other words, I didn't want to push Jesus at people over the radio. I thought that was improper. But I thought it would be proper to kind of open the door for people to think about a religious way of coming at life. And that's the spirit in which I wrote these. Here's another one that I wrote. Our church in Canada reproduced 9 of them then and put them in his bulletin fillers on Sunday morning. I heard the root meaning of the word Catholic the other day. The word Catholic derives from two Greek words, kata and holon. I've written it on the board here in its English transliteration. And it means pertaining to the whole. That's what kata holon means. Kata is pertaining to, and holon is the whole, all of it. I like that. Something is Catholic, that is, if and when it pertains to the whole. In the case of religious faith, I'd like to think that my own tradition is Catholic, and yours too, so long as those traditions really pertain to the whole of the human race. The trouble is, a lot of what I've inherited in my own faith tradition is not sufficiently Catholic. And I guess that's true of yours too, even if your tradition calls itself by that name. I made the point yesterday that even Roman Catholics, you see, are judged by the Catholic tradition that precedes their own. Are any of us really Catholic enough, that is, really whole enough, wide enough, big enough? I hear that definition judging all of us. And as I said yesterday, especially this one document anyhow that I flashed, it represents a kind of a judgment on the churches. Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, this document that suggests an ecumenical consensus about what baptism is and how it ought to be done, and Holy Communion, what Holy Communion is and how it ought to be done, and even ministry, what Christian ministry is. And you want to pick that up in the bookstore if it's of interest to you. You might also want to take a look at my little book. I have an essay in here along with two other people, What is Contemporary Worship, part of a series on open questions in worship. Paul, go ahead.
I haven't actually checked this out for myself, but someone mentioned to me that he wasn't able to find that first resource in the bookstore. And if that's true, is there a way to get it other than that?
Oh, gee, I saw it there just yesterday.
He just didn't find it. Okay.
Look, under the section recommended by...
Okay.
Yeah, ask somebody at the counter. If you can't see it, ask somebody at the counter. They'll tell you. Okay, so we want to give Grandma a vote, and we want to be whole. We want to be as all-embracing as possible. That's the neat thing about this word, kata, holon. Let me say a word, too, expanding a little bit on this word high church and low church. We lived in Europe for a year, and for part of that year we lived in England, and my wife is a family life educator. Some of you may have taken some of her sessions, and there was a big conference on family life in the very city that we were living in England, which was northern England, Leeds. Any of you been to Leeds? Anyhow, we lived in Leeds for 3.5 months, and there was to be a big conference, a professional conference, that involved my wife. And all the members of this professional conference and their spouses were invited to a fancy banquet at the end of the conference. At the end of this week's conference, we were invited to the Lord Mayor's banquet. And it was in the council chambers of the Lord's City Hall, I guess we would call it. And we were sent a very fancy invitation, and I put my collar on and my black suit. And did my wife have a long dress? I forget whether she had a long dress or not. But anyhow, we came up this great big stairway, never having been in this building before, and at the top there was a fellow who, he didn't accost us, but he spoke to us, and he said, "Your name, please." And I thought, oh my goodness, he's going to challenge me, and I don't have the invitation. I forgot to bring the invitation with me. Anyhow, I said, "Reverend and Mrs. Paul Bosch," and with that, he turned around and announced us, "Reverend and Mrs. Paul Bosch." And here at the top of the steps was the Lord Mayor with his chain of office, and the Lady Mayoress, and the head of the conference, and his spouse, and we all shook hands and chatted each other up for a minute. You went inside, and they had sherry and cheese and crackers before the meal began. The meal presently was served, and we all ran into the dining room, and here were linen tablecloths and linen napkins and about 6 forks and about 4 spoons. I mean, it overwhelmed me. They had, would you believe, a soup course and a fish course and a meat course and a different wine with each course. I mean, it was the fanciest meal I have ever eaten. And it was wonderful. I loved every minute of it. Not just because of the nourishment, but also because of the nice table conversation. And I contrast that, in my classes at seminary anyhow, with a backyard barbecue. And here you are in your cutoffs, your blue jeans, and your sandals, and you got a can of Budweiser or Coca-Cola or whatever. And that is a wonderful experience too, right? Very appropriate in its own terms. And I would say that is essentially the difference between high church and low church. It's not as if there's a difference in nourishment. It's not as if there's a difference in human companionship and camaraderie. You can find both at both. The difference is simply etiquette and what you're expected to wear, and you know that whether you have 6 or 7 forks or just a plastic spoon, you know, that kind of thing. And those are relatively insignificant differences. I think there might be times in church when you want to pull out all the stops. Synod ordination service for new pastors. And so you hire up trumpets and trombones and maybe even timpani up in the gallery, and you have a fancy organ and a fancy organist, and you have a big procession, and you carry in candles, and you know, you make a big fuss out of it. And boy, that's kind of nice on occasion. But it's awful nice too at a Bible camp to be sitting around a campfire and sharing the bread and the cup around a campfire. And they're both valid, and they're both, the Lord is present at both, and the human richness of human companionship and camaraderie is present at both, or can be. So, I think that's good to keep in mind. I suggested also yesterday an ecumenical consensus that is unprecedented since before the Reformation. Not since before the Reformation have the churches agreed the way they agree, for instance, in this document. And that is a very heartening thing. What I did not say yesterday, but what I might have said, is where this comes from, this ecumenical consensus in worship. In other fields of the church's life, it may come from different sources, but believe it or not, the interest and the impetus for these kinds of conclusions come from what you might call cultural anthropology. That is to say, they come from phenomenology, big word, and ritual studies. Any of you see the Joseph Campbell series with Bill Moyer on public television? He's one of the world's authorities on human symbols and religious expression and so on. Anyhow, it's that kind of thing that has turned on and excited the people who study my field, which is worship. Significantly, that's not the way it used to be. The way it used to be when I went to seminary, and that's 40 years ago now, you went to seminary and you studied, let's say, the history of liturgy. And you saw, well, this was the Mozarabic Rite, and this is the Sarum Missal, and this is the Mass of 1530 or whatever of Martin Luther, and this is the way John Calvin did it, and so on. And that has its value, and that's still going on. But that's not where the excitement is. The excitement is with ritual studies. Human beings are, as I said last night, ritual enactors. They are constantly inventing new liturgies, new rituals. And so it's not from history, it's not from theology. You talk to a person like Cardinal Ratzinger for the Congregation of the, whatever it is, Protection of the Faith in the Vatican, and he would say, well, this in worship means this, and this is the theology, and so on. That's being done, and that's still important, too, but that's not where all the excitement is. It's not even in aesthetics and the finer things in life. When I went to seminary again, the seminary that I went to, which happened to be Philadelphia Seminary, was one of the few Lutheran seminaries that had courses in worship and church architecture and church hymnody. And we had a teacher who wanted to introduce us country boys to, they were boys in those days, no girls, he wanted to introduce us to the finer things in life. Good architecture, good music, good poetry, good literature, stuff like that. And it opened my eyes, I must say. And I must say further that I found my vocation in this area, as a matter of fact, 5 years after I was ordained. My dad was a pastor, as I said, and I heard the gospel, you know, every Sunday. But I was always a kid who loved the arts. I loved to sing. I was always in the choir. I loved drama. I was always in plays and theater in college and in university and even in seminary. I loved church architecture, and my favorite hobby to this day is going into a space and arranging it in my head. You know, how would I do this for worship? That kind of thing. Going into churches and redesigning them. So I've always had that interest in the arts. And it was 5 years after I was ordained that it occurred to me, because of the influence of people like Henry Horn. Any of you know Henry Horn? Has Henry Horn ever been to Holden Village? He should have been. Is he still alive, Henry Horn? Anyhow, he was a chaplain in Boston, and he turned me on to all of this. And reading a book called Liturgy Coming to Life by J.A.T. Robinson. I should put that on the board. J.A.T. Robinson was an English, a British pastor and bishop, and he wrote a book called Liturgy Coming to Life. And he demonstrated there, and Henry Horn, in years of conversation with him, had demonstrated to me that the place where the Christian faith engages with architecture, theater, music, painting, sculpture, all of the art forms, literature, poetry, the place where all of those art forms engage with Christian faith is, surprise, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Right? You're dealing, you see, with this architectural space, or another one. You're dealing with these hymns and these poetic forms. You're dealing with these gestures, these motions, these actions, and so on, or others. And that really excited me. So I found my vocation, you might say, 5 years after I was ordained, when it occurred to me that faith and the arts engage one another at worship. However, the arts are not the place where all this excitement comes from. Nor is, I should make it clear, market research. We are living in an age when a lot of pastors and congregations are tempted to go to the marketplace and to do some market research and say, we should design our worship, for instance, with the needs of a specific population of people in mind, the baby boomers or whatever. You may have heard of the church growth movement and entertainment evangelism and that kind of stuff. And these are people who say we should target our worship as a marketer would, as a good American free enterprise, to a specific population of people. We should find out what their needs are, and then we should give them what they look for. Now, I think that's pernicious, and I made speeches about that last week, and I suppose I could make some more speeches about it on Thursday if you wanted me to. That seems to me to be a dead end. Martin Marty says, if you go to market research and you design worship on the basis of the presumed needs of a percentage of people out there in the marketplace, what you're doing is allowing the people who know the least about faith to determine the most about its expression. And I think that's dangerous. So, the excitement and the source of stuff like this comes out of anthropology, that is to say, the fact that human beings are liturgy inventors and liturgy enactors. And that's what has turned the liturgical movement on. We have a man at our school, Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario, Ron Grimes, some of you may know of him. He is a world authority in ritual studies. He was brought up as a Methodist, and I think he might still claim to be a Methodist, but his thing is studying the ritual of North American Indians, let's say, Aboriginal people, or the ritual of African animists or whatever. And there are commonalities there. There are certain things that the Christian faith holds in its ritual life, anyhow, holds in common with some other faiths. And these people who write these books talk about ritual actions and ritual objects and ritual times and seasons and so on. I mean, the church year is one example. You could find other examples. Anyhow, that's where the excitement is, and it's made a big difference, I think. Let us move to reverence to the tradition and relevance to the times. We want to be both relevant and reverent. We want to be reverent to the word, reverent to our tradition, and relevant to the world, to our times. We don't want to lose either perspective. I made a big thing last time of the tradition, and I think the tradition is important, and I think the tradition has something to teach us, and I think we want to be faithful to grandpa and grandma as far as we're able. I'm not saying everything old is great, and everything old should be preserved, but a lot of what's old should be preserved, and a lot of what's old is great and needs at least my own reflection, and yours too. We do not have to reinvent the wheel every generation. Somebody did that for us long ago. Furthermore, they made mistakes in the past, grandpa and grandma, and we can avoid their mistakes, let us hope. So I want to look back at the tradition, but I also want to look at our own times, our own contemporary spirit, our own contemporary sensibility, I use that word up there, and ask, what is our own time telling us, and is there stuff there that I would be willing to affirm, willing to say yes to, willing to appropriate, including appropriate in my faith and in my worship? I would like you to interrupt me if you feel moved, and let me invite you now to turn to your neighbor immediately and talk for a minute about what I've said, okay? I'll give you 1 minute, and then we'll call time, and we'll have a little general discussion for a minute. That's one way of getting people involved. Talk to your neighbor. I'll time you. Adiaphora. Yeah, I'm going to come to that in just a minute. If you'll hold on, I'll come to that.
But Is that what we're talking about when you're talking about changing?
Well, adiaphora is a Greek word, and at seminary we were taught that liturgical matters and even matters of church organization are adiaphora.
Right.
That is to say, they are neither commanded nor rejected. They are of neutral importance. And I would have to agree with that. And I would have to say that God doesn't care whether you're using the Greek language or the Latin language or the English language in worship. God doesn't care whether you're dressed in an alb and a stole or whether you're dressed in your bathrobe. But if you're dressed in your bathrobe, you got some explaining to do to the people, right? Doesn't matter to God so long as you're preaching the word. But if you have your bathrobe or your pajamas on, you know, you got to interpret that. Now, so sure, all of this stuff is adiaphora. And from one perspective, that's all I teach at seminary, adiaphora. Church architecture, church music, you know, courses like that. On the other hand, all of these are also, as I use the term, media of meaning. They all are languages. Architecture is a language. And the way a church is arranged speaks a silent sermon to you. As soon as you walk in the door, you're picking up vibes. You may not even be able to articulate it or explain it. But as soon as you walk in the door of a church, maybe even before you, as you're walking down the street and looking at the outside, that church is beginning to speak a sermon to you. Same with vestments, same with music, same with almost anything else that we would call adiaphora. Sure, it's all of secondary importance, but it also speaks. Did I give you the statistic this week? I know I did last week. 55, 38, 8, or 7? 55% of everything you learn about me when you first meet me is nonverbal. In other words, it's the way I walk, the way I stand, the way I move, whether I smile or whether I frown. All of that is, you're picking it up nonverbally. 55%. Don't know how you could possibly demonstrate these statistics, but this is what the social scientists say, and I'll bet they're somewhere near the truth. On top of 55 is 38. 38% is still not the words, the meaning, but it's what they call vocal. In other words, how fast I speak, how slow I speak, whether I whisper or whether I shout. It's the kind of thing you get when you train a puppy. Bad dog. You know, the dog knows something's wrong just by your vocalizing.
Is that what we say? It's not what you
said. Say it again.
It's not what you said. It's your tone of voice.
It's your tone of voice. Yeah, sure. That communicates, does it not? What's left, dear friends? 7%. 7% is the actual content of your words. Now that should give a preacher nightmares. Or a teacher, or a parent, or anybody who tries to communicate. Ronald Reagan was dynamite at this stuff. He knew all of that. Or he had it, you know, subconsciously. He just had a gift for communicating. And Harry Truman, have you ever seen... Do you remember Harry Truman? Are some of you old enough for the Harry Truman chop? Remember how he would, he was a terrible public speaker. Ronald Reagan was a great public speaker. 55% nonverbal, 38% vocal, 7% the words. Now, as you get to know me over these days, for instance, that 7% will probably increase and the vocal and the nonverbal will probably decrease.
I was just going to ask. Our pastor at home, I'm sure I get more than 7%.
Yeah, sure. The moral of the story, well, have you heard that? Again, it must be an apocryphal story, but it's a story about a fellow who's a visitor to a foreign country. I think it was supposed to be South America. And he did not know the language, but he was with an interpreter, a guide, who did know the language. And they were walking in a big city, and they were in a park, and they came to a sidewalk preacher. And the sidewalk preacher was standing on a soapbox, and there was a small crowd gathered around him, and he was pounding his fist in his hand and wagging his finger at the people and frowning and shaking his fist at them, and, abrasive shouts were coming out of his throat. And the foreigner turned to the guide, and he said, "What's the fellow preaching?" And the guide said, "Love." And I wonder how many times does that happen among us on Sunday morning? you know, when the content, the 7% content of our words is contradicted by all the nonverbal stuff. Now, it works the other way around, too. I know some pastors who live such wonderful lives Monday through Saturday and who are such shining examples of Christian discipleship that they could preach heresy on Sunday and the Spirit would cover for them and the people would get the message by the other 7 days or 6 days of the week. But I think we ought to be pretty careful. We ought to make certain that that whole experience of Sunday morning worship communicates what we want it to communicate. And that means some attention paid to the architecture and the music and all these other ways that people communicate. Even the usher at the door. You know, you walk in the door and here's some sullen usher greets you and jams a book in your hand. And, you know, I mean, oh dear, that's terrible. And right away you have a bad impression. Or you go and you sit down all by yourself, lonesome, in the back pew or wherever, or even in the front pew, and nobody speaks to you. You heard the story about the woman who turned to the other woman sitting near her in church, and she said after the service was over, "Are you a stranger in this congregation?" And the woman says, "Yes, I've been a stranger in this church for 15 years. Now, friendliness, you know, is not one of the... I don't suppose it ranks with faith, hope, and love, but maybe it's a form of love. And you know, a friendly church makes a difference to people. Go ahead.
The place, the building, the architecture, speaking the sermon, played out very strongly a number of years ago with my first daughter. She was somewhere between 2 and 3 years old. She was carried in the arms of her grandfather into my brother's church. She had never seen it before, never been in the building. And as soon as my dad brought her into that church, she kind of sat up straight, looked around, and she said, "Church, I like it."
Ooh. She was getting the message.
Just
wonderful.
Spoke to her.
Yeah. I can remember my own little daughter when she was little. I would frequently wear the chasuble, you know, at communion, this garment that, well, they worn it here at Holden, too. Anyhow, she looked at me and she said, "Daddy, are you going to wear your smile today?" She was referring to this. Your smile. I thought that was neat. So then, clearly seen practical implications in how we do worship. But the flip side of that is true also, says Bill Lazarus. There are covert, hidden, not so obvious, theological force in our practice. In other words, what we do has the force of teaching. It has the force of theology. And there's an old Latin phrase that says the same thing in other words. Lex orandi, lex credendi. Lex orandi, lex credendi. And that means the law of prayer is the law of belief. That is to say, the way you pray, the way you worship, affects and teaches and shapes how you believe. I gave my, again, a wonderful, what I regard as a wonderful illustration from my wife brought it home, as a matter of fact. As I say, she's a family life educator, and she came back a couple of years ago now from a conference with the results of a survey. And the survey, Pam has heard this, and maybe some of you were here a couple of weeks ago heard this too. The survey was of married couples, and did they or did they not embrace and kiss before they separated for work in the morning, and did they or did they not embrace and kiss when they came back together again after the day's work was over? They studied a whole lot of variables, but that was the one that they were zeroing in on, and the results of the survey should not surprise any church people, because the results showed that the couples that did indeed embrace and kiss in the beginning of the day and at the end of the day had happier marriages, longer-lasting marriages, more fulfilling marriages than the couples that did not embrace and kiss. And the embrace and kiss made the difference. But the really stunning part of the survey was this. It did not seem to make any difference whether or not they meant it. There are days like that, would you agree? You know, I'm going to kiss you because Jesus wants me to kiss you, not because I feel like it. In other words, just the perfunctory embrace and kiss made a difference. Now, church people come to church Sunday after Sunday, and that shapes them. That affects them. That makes them into different people. Even when we don't feel like it, and we go to church. Even when we don't feel like praying, but we nevertheless pray, that has its effect on you. Walter Huffman at Trinity Seminary talks about an interview he heard with Bob Hope, the comedian. I don't think of him as particularly insightful, but in this instance he was. The interviewer asked, Bob Hope, are you the kind of person off stage that you appear to be when you're on stage, in front of a camera or microphone or whatever? And Hope said, I did not used to be, but now I am. Isn't that significant? If you pretend long enough at one thing, why, you become that thing. And that ought to be good news to us. I mean, I regard that as good news anyhow. Well, moving along, the word written, spoken, enacted. And the word, of course, when we talk about word, when Lutherans talk about word, they always mean the word made flesh which dwelt among us. Capital W, that probably should be. The Word, in other words, is Jesus Christ. And the Word, in the second instance then, is the Scriptures that testify to Jesus, and the preaching that testifies to Jesus, and the sacraments that act that out. And that Word, then, you can see in people's lives as well. Martin Luther's favorite form of the Word was not the written Word, but the spoken Word. Because to be important or valuable to you, you've got to be able to read if it's a book, right? And we have fundamentalists, you know. There's a percentage of Lutherans, as a matter of fact, who are kind of Bible idolaters, I would say. Another person says they have a paper pope. You know, this infallible written word that is not a... I don't think it's a very healthy way to look at the whole situation. That when we talk about the Word, we're talking about chiefly Jesus Christ. The written Word of the Bible, or of hymns, or prayers and so on that you can find in a book, that is a testimony to the Word. Same with preaching. Preaching is a testimony to the Word, Jesus. And, says Martin Luther, that supersedes, and as the spoken Word is even better than the written Word, because A, you have to have eyes, you have to be sighted. B, you have to be literate, you know, to read the written word. C, you have to be taught to read. You know, little kids can't do much with a book. But preaching and conversation, and this wonderful phrase from our tradition, the mutual conversation and consolation of Christian brothers and sisters. Wonderful phrase. You know, you represent the word to a friend when a friend comes to you and talks about their faith life. And you have the opportunity to pronounce forgiveness to that person in Jesus' name. And you have the opportunity to mediate God to that person. And to stand in the place of Jesus. Martin Luther says we are to be Christ to each other. A lot of times hear preachers say we are to be little Christ. But I heard Eric Gritsch, he's a theologian from Gettysburg Seminary. And I heard Eric Gritsch says he's looked all through Luther and there's no little. There's no diminutive. Luther's quotation is, we are to be Christ to each other. We are to take the place, stand in the place of Christ. And that's the mutual conversation and consolation of Christians to each other. Wonderful. So the word is written, it's spoken, it's enacted, and it ain't just adiaphora. Sure, it's adiaphora from one perspective. Completely of secondary importance, whether you're in your pajamas or whether you're in Alb on Sunday morning. But people need people are addressed and spoken to on all these different levels. Well, let us get to therefore, all of these arts are languages or media of meaning or incognitos of grace or whatever. Let us take a look at the modern sensibility, what I call the modern sensibility, five characteristics of contemporary, what it means to be contemporary. I would date the modern movement in all of the arts from about 1912 to maybe last Thursday. Well, no, maybe in the late 60s, because it's disintegrated. This consensus, and I think this is a consensus too, it's a cultural consensus, but this consensus has kind of disintegrated in recent months, almost as recently as that, and we are now in a postmodern period. Neo this and neo that. But for a good chunk of the 20th century, this was the modern sensibility, the modern way of looking at things. And you can see it. I date it from 1912 because 1912, as I understand, was the date of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in, was it in Paris where that was debuted? But do you know the Rite of Spring? Have you ever seen Walt Disney's Fantasia and the dinosaur part of it? Chung, 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 chung. Remember that music? Okay, Stravinsky wrote that music and it was first publicly performed in 1912 and there were people rioting in the streets. It was so unusual and so outrageous to them. He had 5'4" I see that, what's his name? Marty Haugen, or is it Jordan, has 5'4" in some of his things too. I mean, that's very modern, that's modern music. And modern music in 1912 was so offensive, as I say, that there were riots in the street. Also in 1912 was the so-called Armory Show. And in St. Louis in the USA, there was an exhibition of paintings of European modern masters, Picasso and Braque and Cubism and all that kind of stuff. And that was in 1912 in an armory in St. Louis, Missouri, and that caused a riot. Here was Marcel Duchamp nude descending a staircase. And one of the critics says, it looks like an explosion in a shingle factory. You know, it's all crazy shapes. Well, I count that as the beginning of the modern era, and it has lasted until very, very recently. And you can see the same thing in painting, music, architecture, literature, novels, movies, plays, all the arts, I believe. And this is what they say. First of all, not romance, but reality. The modern movement came out of the Victorian movement. And the Victorians, as you may know, loved to overstate everything. And there was purple passion in all of their writing and in all of their music and in all of their architecture and in all of their design. I happen to be very fond of Victorian, and I had until last year when we sold it and bought a little townhouse condominium. I owned a Victorian home, and it was filled, still is, or even our new place, is filled with Victorian antiques. And Victorians were exploring all the limits that a power jigsaw and a power lathe would provide for them. So they had doodads and spindles and gingerbread all over everything. It's a terrible thing to dust or to try to paint if you're painting the exterior of your house. But the Victorians loved all that clutter and all of that overstatement and all of that purple passion. And the modern movement came along. Victorian movement, you see, went up until the new century. But the modern movement began to turn its back on all of that and say, look, let's be a little more understated. Which brings us to less is more. Less is more was a watchword of the International School of Architects from Germany, the so-called Bauhaus School of Architects. Mies van der Rohe and Gropius and Corbusier, these architects, and they said, less is more. By which they meant, do not overstate the case. Make it simple. And so the skylines of our cities were changed, and the same thing happened in literature and in music and in other areas of life too. Ernest Hemingway comes along about this time, and all of his prose, beautiful prose, the content of his stories is another matter altogether. Some of it is kind of macho adolescent posturing, in my view. But his prose style is nouns and verbs. There's almost no adjectives or adverbs. And I can remember one of my teachers way back in the dark ages telling me the adjective is the enemy of the noun. And if you read Ernest Hemingway, it's all strong nouns and verbs. Wonderful. It's very biblical, may I say. You read a story like the story of Abraham and Isaac in the Bible, and here is a wonderful opportunity to pull out all the stops and get very passionate and romantic. Here's his father going to murder his dear little boy. You could have a great opportunity there for overselling and overstating. But what do you read? The little boy says, here is the fire and here is the knife, but where is the sacrifice, my father? And Abraham replies, God will provide the sacrifice. And the Bible says, he stretched out his hand and he took the knife. I mean, wonderful. It's all nouns and verbs in that account. A great temptation there to be, overstating the case. But the literature is very simple, very austere, and nevertheless very moving. I mean, it really gets me. And of course, God does provide a sacrifice than the ram caught in the thicket. So, less is more. You find buildings that have very, very austere, simple lines. Sometimes even the technology is exposed. Pompidou Center in Paris. Many of the skyscrapers on our skyline in our cities. But the same is true in music, the same is true in other art forms as well, I would argue. Form follows function. This was another byword of the Bauhaus School, the International School of Architects. They said the form of something ought to show what it does, what it is useful for. And this is a contrast to previous ways of looking at the world. Let me show you this chair. The Greeks had an idea that this chair is made up of substance and accidents. Those were the terms they used. The substance of the chair is its chairness, the fact that it lives up to some kind of heavenly ideal of chair that God has up in heaven, an ideal vision of chair. The accidents of chair is the fact oak, that is this square by this square, that it's got four legs and so on. Those are the accidents. But the substance of it is this heavenly ideal that's in God's mind. Now, that's the Greek understanding of beauty, and you see the Greek sculptures, for instance, of the Venus de Milo or the discus thrower, and they are ideal human proportions, presumably. The Hebrews didn't think that way. I should say, before we leave the Greek, this is where the idea of transubstantiation comes from. The philosophers from the Middle Ages took the Greek concepts and they said the accidents of the bread still looks like bread, still looks like wine, but the substance has been changed to body and blood. So that's where you get the idea of transubstantiation. Martin Luther and people today don't even talk in those terms anymore. I mean, we don't have Greek concepts of, they've been superseded by Newton, and that's been superseded by Einstein, and that's been superseded by quantum physics. I mean, we don't talk about chairs or bread or wine or anything in the natural world that way anymore. Anyhow, the Hebrews thought in functional terms. And a chair was not a chair insofar as it lived up to its heavenly ideal, but a chair was a chair if you could sit on it, and if it invited you to sit on it. Barbara Streisand's nose. You would never find that nose on a Greek statue, but she sings through it. Boy, oh boy, does she. I mean, she's a marvelous singer, I think. And form follows function, in other words. Eros Aronin, a modern architect, designs a chair called the pedestal chair. He said he came into a room and he looked around and he saw a slum of chair legs. And he didn't like it. So he built a chair that's, you couldn't do it without modern technology, aluminum pedestal, very, very beautiful shell of aluminum and aluminum pedestal. Doesn't look anything like a four-legged chair, but you can sit on it, and you want to sit on it. So form follows function, and exchange from the Greek concepts of beauty, ideal, to a Hebrew concept of beauty, functional. And functional almost to the point of ethical. I mean, the Hebrews, you know, beauty is as beauty does, in other words. That there's an ethical dimension to Hebrew. The Hebrews talk about the beauty of holiness. And, you know, I think all of that bears reflection, and I'm willing to endorse that. I'm willing to endorse all of these things. The medium is the message. That's the next characteristic of modern thought and modern art. Marcia McLuhan is the media watcher who said that. I wouldn't say the medium is the message. I would say that the medium is a big part of the message. And we're back to this 55-38-7. In other words, the way you speak, the way you present it, the architecture of the building, the vestments, the drama, the music, all of that contributes. And we should not be unconscious of the nonverbal stuff that's going on. We should put that to work for the gospel. So the medium is at least a big part of the message, if not the whole message. I don't think it is the whole message, but it's a big part of it. And then finally, a willingness to shock. We live in an age of cultural inflation. You go into the supermarket and you hear Muzak playing. You go into the dentist's office and wait in the waiting room and there's Muzak playing. You go into the elevator in the high-rise apartment and there's Muzak playing. What do we do when we're surrounded with stuff like that? Tune out, exactly. We turn it all off. We do not listen anymore. Same with visual images. You're bombarded on every side with visual images. One of the neat things about Holden Village, you know, posters, billboards, television screaming at you, most of it with commercial intent. I mean, they want to separate you from your money. What have we learned to do in that instance? Tune it out. And so we become very cynical. When you live in an age of that kind of what I would call cultural inflation, you become cynical. And you tune it all out, and you don't take any of it seriously. And so modern musicians and architects and artists and playwrights and filmmakers and so on, they are willing to shock, I would say at its best anyhow, wanting to honor the Eighth Commandment. What's the Eighth Commandment? Little catechism here. Not bear false witness. You shall not bear false witness. I see modern arts at their best. Now, a lot of times they're charlatans. I'll admit that. But at their best, modern art, modern painting, modern architecture, modern music, modern movies, modern books, novels, poetry, all of that stuff at its best means to honor the word and honor truthfulness. They had every Sunday in CBC, as I say, I'm an American living these days in Canada, near Toronto, and they have the CBC in Toronto, in Canada, maybe you've heard of, wonderful public broadcasting, and they have a public call-in talk show every Sunday afternoon. And a couple of years ago, after the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, remember that scandal? And then the Jimmy Swaggart scandal, remember that? They had a talk show, and the question was, have these scandals of the television evangelists shaken your faith in the television evangelists? And caller after caller, I never listened to the program, but I just happened to be tuning it in one Sunday afternoon, and caller after caller phoned in and said, I never trusted those guys to begin with. They're a bunch of snake oil salesmen. I mean, it was kind of scary at how cynical everybody was. And they didn't, you know, we don't trust our politicians these days. We don't trust our preachers. We don't trust our doctors. They're just out to make a lot of money. We don't trust lawyers. They're a bunch of, you know, read John Grisham's novels. Anyhow, all of that, it seems to me, is part of the contemporary sensibility and It lasted until last Thursday, as I say. Well, a couple of years before that. This consensus began to disintegrate, and we are living now in a time that some people call postmodern. And postmodern means that some of these things are being forgotten or ignored or actually contradicted. And you see Philip Johnson, for instance, one of the world's great architects who's done some wonderful stuff. But in New York City, he builds a high-rise, a huge skyscraper, and it has a broken pediment at the top. You know what a broken pediment is? That's a broken pediment. I mean, it's from Renaissance and from Greek even before that. In other words, it's neoclassical, you might say, or neo-Renaissance. You can find neo-Baroque. John Updike is a favorite author of mine. And if you know his writing, it's nothing like Ernest Hemingway. It's almost neo-Baroque. Lots of adjectives. I like it also. But it's not in this sensibility. It's different. What else? Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company. In Pittsburgh, have you seen that? It's like a little Gothic building. It has little tiny pointed at the top of the building. It's a skyscraper, but it's made out of glass. But on the top of it is little pointy Gothic. You know, it's kind of neo-Gothic, in other words. So we're living in a neo-age. What do you need to be modern? Well, if you want to be this sensibility, this modern sensibility here that I'm talking about, let's take a look at the difference between hymn 518 and hymn 320. Now, both of these are old hymns. Hymn 518 is not as old as hymn 320. But it's interesting to see, put them side by side. 518 is Beautiful Savior, and that's a Victorian hymn. Actually, it goes back to the 1600s, doesn't it? But it's translated in the Victorian era by Joseph Seiss. Beautiful Savior, King of creation, Son of truly I love thee. Beautiful, fair are the meadows, fair are the woodland. Again, it's kind of romantic, you might say, the words of this poem. We're not counting the music now, we're just looking at the poem. The words of the poem are kind of romantic and you might even say sentimental. Now turn to hymn 320. This is Isaac Watts. Not written in our era, but it is very contemporary. Look at those words. O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from the stormy blast, one adjective, and our eternal home, another adjective. Two adjectives in six stanzas. It's a marvelous, maybe it's six adjectives. I counted it up at one time. But I mean, it's very austere, simple language, nouns and verbs. And I would argue that O God, our help in ages past is a quote unquote modern hymn in a way that Beautiful Savior is not a modern hymn. Now, they're both lovely hymns and I like to sing both of them. But one has the modern spirit, I would say, and the other does not. Likewise, a lot of what passes for modern these days, contemporary gospel stuff, rock, gospel rock and gospel pop and that kind of stuff, is really Victorian. It's not modern. You want to talk? Let's talk.
Well, partly I need to...
Oh, yes, you had this quote.
If I'm going to, I need to do it because I have to go help with Vespers.
Help.
Okay. How many have heard about Herbert Brokering? Heard of Herbert Brokering? I have a wonderful book here. It was published by Concordia Publishing House in 1977 called Lord If. And it's page after page of these short little prayers almost, stating, Lord, if some said of something, which is pretty much beyond reasonable doubt, is true, then. And then the then follows
implications.
Something to do with ourselves, exactly. Anyway, I was telling Paul earlier that I just happened to be reading through this today and I found one that I thought might be appropriate. Not having been to his session on this last week, I didn't know for sure. But I'll read it through it, and I'd like to read it twice so that we can really let it sink in. I have the benefit of having it in front of me. Lord, if electronic music can make so many combinations, and if there are so many themes and moods in harmony and rhythm, then surely you are more generous than I act, more flexible than we can ever imagine, and as understanding as I need.
What was that last part? You should read the whole thing over again.
Exactly. I said, because I have the benefit of having it in front of me, it's easier. Lord, if electronic music can make so many combinations, and if there are so many themes and moods in harmony and rhythm, then surely you are more generous than I act, more flexible than we can ever imagine, and as understanding as I need.
And as understanding.
As I need.
As I need. Wonderful. Let's have some conversation about all of this. Don't be scared.
Well, the last point that you made about that which we call contemporary worship today, frequently being Victorian, you know, flowery, lots of frills and sentiment. I mean, that struck me because I'm one who is frequently leading quote unquote contemporary worship in my congregation, and I guess I'm curious in exploring that a little bit more. And so, what you're saying is, if we truly want to be contemporary, we have to deal with this modern, postmodern idea relative to the Victorian.
I would urge that, yeah. And a lot of so-called contemporary service that I've seen, although they're dressed up with microphones and electronic mixing boards and overhead projectors and all that kind of stuff, they're really Victorian tent revival meetings. Which, just have some of you experienced that? Entertainment evangelism and some of the mega churches, you know, they put on a big show and they have people coming in the door, they do. There's no question about that, but I ask, is that the only value? Do you want people coming in the door at any cost?
What is the cost?
That's
one of the things you have to look at. I mean,
I tell these people, if you want people to come in the door, hire Madonna or hire U2 or, you know, one of the rock bands. Yeah. Then you'll get lots of people. But are they being invited into the full truth about God?
Yeah. The message, the faith, the depth of
Are we doing them a favor?